Good morning.
Good morning.
It's very good to be here. I'm delighted to be with you. And I bring warm greetings from Mennonite Church Canada, where I work, our denominational body where we partner together in God's mission across the street and around the world. And I'd be happy to talk with you further after the service about the Resource Center, where I do manage. And you might be surprised to find how many resources, worship, parenting, family, church education, small group study, or other kinds of resources that are available for loan, and I'd be happy to send your way. I've been asked to tell a few stories this morning, stories that encourage us to discern how God is present in our lives, to look for God, indeed even see God. And then with these eyes of faith, to join in God's ministry of healing and hope. My wife Judith and I have been planning the canoe trip for months. A map of Algonquin, a provincial park in northern Ontario, had been spread out on our living room floor as we began to calculate distances and contemplate long portages and plan our route through the lake and river systems of the park's interior. We spent the last week planning our food menus, gathering supplies, and puzzling how we would put a long canoe on a short Chev Sprint. But by the time that June day arrived, we were ready and eager to go. After 6 hours of driving, we approached the park and turned onto the last 45-kilometer stretch of road. Its rich, overarching canopy of trees, its meandering, narrow personality, its rugged surface, and the fact that few ever traveled its rough gravel pathway kind of lured and attracted us. We prided ourselves with our bravery and sense of adventure. Well, such naivety quickly dissipated with the first drops of rain, and then disappeared entirely as the water streamed through our natural umbrella above us, pelting the ground and turning it to mud, making its texture something akin to grandmother's washboard. We moaned and groaned with the car as it bounced over huge potholes and through deep mud sloughs, and with the canoe rocking precariously on top. We were delayed by 2 hours because of that road. And we watched the sun set from that road. We watched the wipers do their rhythmic dance across the windshield. And all romanticism was gone. When we finally reached Lake Magnetowan, our starting point, the sun was gone. And we asked ourselves, do we really want to spend the night feet crossed and sitting upright in our little car? I was feeling claustrophobic, and Judith had mentioned something about bad body odor. The only other option, though, was to risk canoeing across the lake in the dark to the nearest campsite in the rain with only a small pocket flashlight. How does one get oneself into these types of predicaments? As we sheepishly navigated our small craft in the dark, we also frantically started bailing out water from the canoe. At the campsite, knee-deep in floating pine needles, it didn't take more than a small flashlight to realize there was nothing high and dry. And of course, when you set up rain, camp in the rain, before the ground sheet is laid and the flies properly secured, you're never really sure whether the tent fabric is drier on the inside or the outside. And then you discover that such matters are irrelevant anyway if your sleeping bag's already wet. The next morning, unfortunately, brought no immediate relief. We now had to contend with each other's cantankerous company. Adding insult to injury through the dripping tent flaps, we could still see the car we had left behind the night before, and we could imagine its dry interior. It was after about a dozen games of two-handed euchre that we finally ventured out into the rain, managing to canoe short stretches between frequent downpours. It was readily apparent to us now that the precise calculations we had made from our living room floor were irrelevant. Outside, there really was only one life form that found pleasure in the damp surroundings, the all-too-common mosquito. And perhaps there were millions of them, I don't know. None, I'm sure, had tasted the delicacy of human blood for some time, though. It was while we balanced our canoe with both our hands on top of our heads during the kilometer-long portages that the mosquitoes won the war. And they took full advantage of our vulnerability. In the end, they fell in love with Muscal and Deep Woods Off and all the other artillery we could muster, and ended up colonizing on one of my ears that eventually swelled to 3 times its normal size. Finally, on the third day, or 59th hour, we dug deep into our packs for the buried sunscreen and enjoyed the expanse of a clear blue sky. And for a moment, we could lie sunward and let the current lazily send us adrift. And then, to our surprise, the bulrushes started to quiver, and the ripples in the lake became more intense. And to our shock, what we thought were bulrushes were, in fact, not bulrushes at all, but the giant rack of a male bull moose. I was sure it was Leviathan itself, the great sea serpent of the Bible, or the Loch Ness Monster. And he looked a tad bit temperamental. So we instinctively began to back paddle. And it was only then that we noticed the female with their calf, about a stone's throw away. So we back paddled some more. And then behind us, to our surprise, was another one. And it was like the Bermuda Triangle. For about an hour, we sat there, helping the canoe tread water, trying to look inconspicuous. It was in that uncomfortable position that we finally had some time to think, to recall the events of the trip. The 40-pound snapping turtle I almost stepped on coming out of the tent that morning. The paddle that got away. Our precarious perch on top of a rock in the middle of the lake, knowing the slightest movement would tip the boat and we'd lose everything. Or last night's sleep under sticky, sweaty covers, and how we had longed to swim but decided not to share the water with 4-inch leeches. The fresh bear prints along our portage and around the campsite. There had been some unexpected anxieties. But as the water continued to lap at the canoe, and we waited for clearance from the canoe moose traffic controller, we thought of the wonder in this adventure as well. And we thought about God's real presence in nature. And we were filled with gratitude. Each night as we fell asleep, we heard the calls of loons echoing across the lakes. We ended up encountering 13 moose, some with newborn calves, and we always marveled at their size, grace, and beauty. We saw a white heron perched on a rock in the middle of a waterfall. We camped on an island by ourselves in the middle of Daisy Lake and cooked bannock over the fire. And the outhouses, just these crude boxes without any walls, were sometimes ideally perched on top of the hill so you could sit there and watch the sunset over the lake. There had also been some unexpected blessings. How different one's perspective can be at any given moment. Riddled with anxiety or intrigued by wonder, paralyzed by fear, or overwhelmed by joy, trapped in the ordinary, or suddenly aware of the extraordinary. How well do we see? I don't know if it was a Monday or a Tuesday. Actually, come to think of it, it may have been a Wednesday. I was never really good at keeping time. One day kind of blurred into another. There was really little to distinguish the rhythms of my day. Each morning I'd habitually lay down my mat on Main Street in Bethsaida the corner of Augustus and Main, and I beg for a few coins, just a few copper pennies in my tin cup. Same place every day. What's the blind man to do? Come to think of it, it must have been a Thursday. The streets were always busier on a Thursday, and there was definitely a crowd that morning. You know, I've often been told that my other senses are especially keen since I'm blind. For instance, I listen well. I heard the crowd approaching, and from a distance I recognized that something was different. And my curiosity was, well, before I could even think, Marcus and Samuel startled me, friends of mine, picked me up. In a swift, sweeping motion, they had lifted me in the air and put me on their shoulders. Where are you taking me? My tin cup and blanket were left behind. They didn't answer, but the noise was getting louder. What's going on? And again, they were quiet. And above the din of the crowd, there was one man speaking. His voice grew louder as we approached. I felt my friends jostling through the crowd. I sat on top precariously, still wondering about my destination. I could sense the restlessness. People were packed in tight, and we were inching our way forward. I could now hear the teacher's words. Whoever wants to be first must be last. Whoever welcomes a child welcomes me. I mean, what did that mean? And then he stopped mid-sentence as I was lowered to the ground, and I felt his hand on my shoulder. Arlen. Who's this person who knows my name? I was curious and a bit nervous. His voice was unfamiliar, but yet strangely, well, I don't know, as if I knew it from somewhere. Arlen, can you see? No, sir, I'm blind, I replied. I couldn't see. I felt moisture on my eyes like he had applied his own saliva. Now, can you see anything? I see people, sir. I see many people. I'm astonished. It's like my eyes are being opened. But they look strange. They look like trees. These people look like trees walking. It takes time to see. The man touched my eyes again. And when I opened them a second time, I saw his face looking at me clearly. I could see bright hues and detailed markings, shadows and vistas, contours and... Well, he took my hand and he helped me stand. My name is Jesus, he said. I'm going on ahead. Why don't you come and see? I joined him and the crowd that followed, a large crowd. I could clearly see that now. It must have been a Thursday.
Okay, we're having an interview in the middle of the sermon for number 20, Come and See. And before you start playing, Evan, I'll explain how we're going to do it. Number 20. Wait till you all get to the page. This is marked as three separate verses. The top two lines are marked as verses 1 and 2, and the bottom set of stanzas is marked as verse 3. But the way we're going to do it is we're going to sing the whole thing through twice. Verse 1 followed by 3 as the chorus, and then verse 2 followed by 3 as the chorus. And you'll notice that when we get to what is verse 3 or the chorus, it now splits into two lines. And what I'd like us to do is just split down the middle, and everybody on that side sing the top line, and everybody on that side sing the bottom line. And then it's sort of like a round, but both parts should be singable by all voices. Does that make sense? any clarification needed? So number four, basically, come and see, that line, verse 1, and then go right down to verse 3 as the chorus, and then go back up and sing verse 2, the first two lines, and then drop down into verse 3 again as the chorus. So that's how it
goes. It's like trees walking around.
And this is because the two books of music we have don't match each other, so the accompaniment does it as two separate verses, so that's what we're doing.
Judith Kirk. To sense is to encounter the majesty of God. The wonder, the joy, the inspiration, the gentleness, experiencing God in fullness, learning how to comprehend how blessed we are, and so loved to be given such a sense of the glory of God. To see is to sense the creativeness of God, the wings of a butterfly, the wonders of wilderness, overwhelmed by the beauty of creation, revived. How blind we are, yet so loved, to be given such a sense of the glory of God. In her book, Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, Annie Dillard writes of reading Marius van Senden's book, Space and Sight, in which he describes the time when surgeons discovered how to successfully remove cataracts. The surgeons then fanned out across the United States and Europe, performing operations, many of them on patients who had lived with blindness since birth. The surgeon's case reports described the terror that sometimes ensued. The patients, blind since birth, had not developed the necessary pathways between eyes and brain. And their eyes could register images, but their brains couldn't make any sense out of them, because they had never learned to see. Annie writes of one man who practiced his vision by taking one of his boots, throwing it a distance, and trying to gauge how far away it was. And throw by throw, boot by boot, the man worked to gain a sense of perspective. A keen sense of sight takes practice. Spiritual vision takes discipline. Seeing God at work often requires a renewed perspective. As I said, our family spent a term with MCC in New Orleans, Louisiana, a few years ago, and our eyes were slowly opened to the realities of poverty and racial injustice. It was in that sometimes difficult situation that my wife met an angel. A special person who helped shed a few scales from her eyes. And this is her story. The angel didn't look at all like I thought an angel ought to look. It wasn't white. He was black. It wasn't celestial, though he certainly came from a different world. He carried no wings, just a shopping cart. My encounter happened one day when I was walking along our neighborhood street in New Orleans. I was on my regular route to work. But that day, I was in a particularly bad mood. A lot of things hadn't been going well, and I was worried about my family, and I had a lot of big decisions to make. And then I met him. An African-American man walking towards me. He was wearing dirty clothes. He was pushing a shopping cart. He was likely homeless and obviously quite poor. Now, I walked along this street almost every day, and I had come to recognize most of the people. But I had never seen this man before. And since I was so upset and self-absorbed, I really didn't want to even talk to him. I was sure he was just going to ask for money. So contrary to all cultural protocol, I moved to the edge of the sidewalk, looked away, and walked right past without a greeting. But as I walked by, something made me turn and look at him. And he also stopped and turned back towards me. And then we had the most interesting conversation. He asked me all kinds of questions. Not, can you spare a dollar or do you have a bus ticket? Not questions like those, but deep, penetrating questions, personal questions that were actually quite disturbing. He seemed to know exactly how I was feeling. And I didn't want to really answer his personal questions, so I tried to make them into a bit of a joke. And he would always counter, saying, but that's not what I asked. And of course, he was right. There was something certainly intriguing about this gentleman. And then, to my surprise, he pulled out a Bible out of his coat pocket, and right there in the middle of the sidewalk on Felicity Street, he asked me to read a story about Jesus. And it cut straight to the matter. When I finished reading, he put the Bible in his pocket, looked at me in the eye, and said, "You know, you just have to get up every morning and praise the Lord." I'd never seen him before, and I never saw him again. But he seemed to know quite a lot about me. He knew exactly what questions to ask and the types of things I needed to hear. I still remember his face. It was like talking to God. Jan Richardson, in her book, In Wisdom's Path, describes seeing as a process. Something that is not a given even for people whose eyes have always worked. "I miss thousands of details a day," she says, "overlooking the God who dwells in the commonplace. Passing by the smoldering bush that might have burst into flame had I gazed on it long enough. She tells of her daily practice of going to the edge of a pond. I stayed until I saw something I might otherwise have missed. It was often just as I turned to go, thinking there was nothing new, that my unseen began to erode. Do we have the patience to wait? Do we have the keen eyesight that sees the extraordinary or the new or the surprising presence of God? Maybe most importantly, can we trust that God will come? Let me share with you a final story told recently by Lillian Haas, one of Mennonite Church Canada's witness workers in Africa. A few months ago in the small village of Tin in Burkina Faso, thieves broke into Lillian's courtyard and stole her solar panels, her only source of electricity. And the panels had been held in a secure metal frame with two heavy-duty locks. The heavy metal pipe that held them was 12 feet high and firmly cemented into the ground. The thieves cut this 3-inch pipe with a pipe cutter about a meter from the ground and took the pipe and the frame and the solar panels all in one piece to the bush about a kilometer away. And there they pried it apart and removed the solar panels and took off, leaving the frame behind. The elders of the village quickly held a meeting the next morning and decided to call on God to strike the thieves with lightning. They would pray and they would earnestly ask God to act justly. Lillian was called to the meeting to give her blessing on this decision. She was a Christian, they surmised, a religious person. Certainly she too could pray for God's vengeance. Lillian feared speaking against the community leaders, but she honestly told them how she could not give her blessing to their plan. This news shocked the elders, and they couldn't believe Lillian was serious in her opposition. What other option could there be? Lillian thought quickly. Oh yes, I can pray, she proposed. But I must pray differently. Instead of asking God to hurt, I mean the temptation she too faced, I'll ask God to help. I'll ask God to find the thieves and change their minds. I'll ask God to persuade the thieves to return the solar panels. I'll ask God to change the hearts of the thieves so that they will become people who no longer steal, but who will follow God instead. The elders didn't know what to do with Lillian's intentions. I mean, might God actually be merciful? Might God honor a different approach to justice? And have we been blind to ways that God actually might work? Reluctantly, they accepted Lillian's request to wait. So Lillian finishes her letter simply writing, "We are now waiting patiently for God to work. Pray that we will have the eyes to see." Whether your coming week is like a canoe adventure where we are confronted to make a choice, am I unnecessarily anxious or full of wonder? Am I afraid or am I full of joy? Or we find ourselves this week patiently waiting to see God's activity, standing at the edge of a pond, or feeling Jesus' healing touch on our eyes as we sit at the roadside. Or perhaps it's our week for an unexpected encounter. Are our eyes open to an angel?